Welcome to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is the Tuesday morning after, and we are 29 days into the month of November. My name is Tamara Filievich, and I will be your host for the next 2 hours. Monday through Friday, Radio CKUT brings you independent, community-based arts, culture, current affairs, and musical talent from Montreal and beyond. To reach the morning afters or to get involved, follow updates at CKUT on Twitter at CKUT or www.ckut.ca or call 514-448-4041, extension 2593. We will be with you until 9 a.m. Up on today's show, we will continue our discussion of Canadian prison industrial complex started last week with the look at the opposition to Bill C-10. On today's show, we have Justin Pichet, a sociology professor and an author of a blog called Tracking Politics of Canadian Crime and Punishment System, as well as Kim Pate from Elizabeth Fry Society. Both were interviewed last week by CKUT's Alana McNevin. Also at this hour, the Association of the People's Campus Coalition is a brand new grassroots association emerging at Concordia University. Today we will have one of its organizers, Alex Metak, on the phone to talk to us about why this group emerged and the importance of reclaiming campus space for political purpose. And of course, as usual, we will have our weekly literary report with Jeffrey Mackey and Voices of Egypt with Ilyan Bakhtar. All this and more is coming up next, so stay tuned.
I'm at the Faculty of Law at the University of Ottawa.
Okay, thank you. The first thing I would like to talk about is that there's a disproportionate amount of Aboriginal women who are incarcerated, and a number of those are young, young Aboriginal women. In a report by the NWAC, it was stated that the rising incarceration rate of Aboriginal girls between 1973 and 2007 stands as a stark contrast to every other indicator of decline. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. One of the things that we know is that women, even while the rates of men being imprisoned has been going down over time, the rates of women being imprisoned has been going up, and in particular for women with mental health issues, and most especially for Indigenous women. So we've seen an increase since in the past 20 years, really, from women being about 12 to 13% of the of Indigenous women being 12 to 13% of the federal jail population to now being 34% of the federal jail population and rising. And when we look at those who are classified as higher security, is even greater overrepresentation. That we, in fact, there was just a new resource opened up in Edmonton, which is great. It was opened by Native Counseling Services of Alberta, and they opened up a house for women, and it was supposed to be for women who are minimum security, and there should have been, according to corrections' own stats and how they do the classification, really there should have been more than enough women to fill that house. and yet they only had 3 Indigenous women who qualified to be there, which tells you that the women are vastly overclassified. And certainly if you walk into any of the maximum security units, Indigenous women are very much overrepresented. In 2003, the Canadian Human Rights Commission found that the classification scheme used by by the Correctional Service of Canada was racist in the sense that there was racial discrimination, and found that it violated women's human rights as a result of that. Now, that doesn't mean, it could mean, from time to time there may be individual decisions, but what they were really looking at was the systemic issues of the fact that social condition disadvantages that can't be dealt with by individuals. So things like where you grew up, whether in fact other people in your family have criminal records, whether in fact you've had the supports and benefits of individuals in your life who can assist with your education, whether other people have post-secondary education, things that you actually can't change can influence how you're classified when you come into the system. So the Canadian Human Rights Commission found that that was a problem, and certainly we see it very graphically and starkly and tragically when you walk into any of the prisons because of the overrepresentation, one, of Indigenous women in particular, and the overclassification of them as higher security, mainly not because of the rest of public safety, but because of their issues about which they can do little, if anything, to change.
Can you address basically some of these socioeconomic problems that force women into a sort of endless cycle of criminality and despair?
So some of the things we know is that certainly starting with the fact that they're women. I mean, the Human Rights Commission found that women in federal prisons were discriminated on the basis of gender, on the basis of race, and on the basis of disability. And so breaking those down on the basis of gender, we know that historically women were overrepresented in social services and health services, particularly mental health care, because if women were seen as acting outside of the norm of a stereotype of femininity, they would often be seen as somehow crazy or mad, and if they did something really that was harmful, that caused serious harm or was violent, then they were often seen as particularly bad, and not to be too colloquial about it, but really they were so tended to be dichotomized. And so we would see women with mental health issues as the progressive trends to deinstitutionalize those areas were under-resourced with the deficit cuts that came in the last 20, 30 years. We have seen more of those women end up in the prison system, largely because they have mental health issues or are dealing with post-traumatic stress because they've had experiences of abuse, that sort of thing. And so we know that 91% of the Indigenous women and about 80% of all of the women overall have histories of physical and or sexual abuse, that many of them don't get any support to address those issues, as we know that only 1 in 10 of such incidents are often even reported, much less are the victims ever supported and assisted. And so many of those women end up, either on the street doing, sometimes they self-medicate and anesthetize themselves to the realities they've experienced, and sometimes they end up developing responses that are maybe described as mental health issues or maybe labeled as psychiatric conditions. So we see that. We've also seen the backlash to violence against women, that as women, even though women are told that they're not, that they're entitled to resist sexual and physical violence, the reality is very little state support and community support, and often even familial support for them to do that. And so we have the horrible position of, and tragic position of, women often ending up being essentially deputized by the state. So we've had the retreat of services that might support women and assist women. We've had many, many situations where it's clear police don't come when they're called, or women don't call the police because of other reasons of fear. And when they do call, they may not get the supports they need, and yet the minute they act to defend defend themselves and or their children or other family members, they're often then the full weight of the law comes down on top of them. And so we see a lot of women in situations that are, you know, often characterized as either countercharged or cross-charged or charged themselves for defending themselves when they call the police to assist them, or if they've used lethal force, then obviously they are certainly often charged, even in situations where it is at the very least reactive violence, but often self-defense or defensive violence. So that's another area we've seen increases. And then the fact that women, Indigenous women in particular, are more likely to be poor, more likely to have more limited access to health care, education, social services. We're more likely to see them come to the attention of the state also because they're documented from birth to death because of the Indian Act. And so we see more of them necessarily coming to the attention of the authorities, often first through child welfare, then into the youth system, and then through into the adult system. So we see a real trajectory of really sucking people, those who are the most marginalized, most depressed, into the criminal system because of the cuts to all those other areas. So those are some of the factors we're seeing that are causing that kind of increase. And then add to that that they're often taken far from home. They, whatever communities of support they have, often disintegrate during the periods of their incarceration unless they're doing very short periods. And so if they're, many of them are mothers, often the sole supports of their children before they go to prison, their children may end up in care. In some of the provinces now, temporary guardianship becomes permanent guardianship fairly quickly. In Alberta, I think it is, it's now 6 months after someone's taken into temporary care, they can be put in permanent care. The fact that there's no legal aid, and often for civil matters, means that many of those women aren't able to get to court because they're in prison. They don't even have a representative because they can't get legal aid. And so their children end up taken into care. And so we see the, you know, the impacts there also of multi-generational disadvantage and oppression. So we end up seeing women not only lose their communities of support, but lose the children for whom they may be wanting to return to the community. And so sometimes oftentimes we hear women talk about losing hope as well. So those are some of the issues that that women face in particular, that men face sometimes as well, but it's certainly magnified when we talk about women.
The current bill that was tabled in September is an amalgamation of 9 previous crime and justice bills that the government introduced in the last parliament, and which died whenever the May 2nd election was called. One of those former bills was Bill C-56, also called Protecting Vulnerable Foreign Nationals Against Trafficking, Abuse, and Exploitation. One of the aims that this bill seeks is, or claims that it seeks to make, is to make it possible to deny work permits to people who are vulnerable to abuse or exploitation, including exotic dancers, low-skilled laborers, and victims of human trafficking. How will this bill affect women who women in society right now?
Well, I think that it's brought in as though it's some kind of almost noblesse oblige approach to protecting women, when in fact it will do just the opposite. It would be because already we see that those who are trafficked into the country often themselves end up in circumstances where they're essentially criminalized because of their disadvantage and their oppression. And this now makes that much more explicit and allows it to happen, that instead of allowing people to have refugee status, women who are being exploited, who are being victimized, to enter the country in their own right, then there will be other ways, you know, whether it's through arranged marriages, whether it's through pretending people are coming to be do other kinds of domestic or other kinds of agricultural or other kinds of work, and then putting them in those positions of in the sex trade. Then I think, you know, we're likely to see even more risky situation for many of those, especially women and children, but you know, more broadly too. There are certainly some young men who are being brought into the country at times that way. The other issue that's not addressed, the trafficking issue that's not addressed by that is the trafficking that happens within our country. When I worked with young people and when I worked out west, we saw many times young people in particular, but also women being shuttled around the country between provinces as a way to try and, one, keep them destabilized, but also to keep them from under the gaze of the authorities. And so we have the issue of women being trafficked within the country, and particularly the issues that Native Women's Association of Canada and others have raised around the missing and murdered Indigenous women in this country. So we should make this a much broader concern than just people coming into the country and immigration issues.
With the new prisons that are being proposed to be built, do you know what percentage of them are going to be like women's prisons, men's prisons? From looking at what's been proposed, are these services going to be accommodated or taken into consideration for the new prisons being built?
It's interesting that corrections, I was just corrected last week when I started talking about the new prisons being built, and I was told, there aren't going to be any new prisons being built, they're just adding to all the existing prisons. Now, if that is true, one, I don't think that's true. I mean, it may very well be in the plans, but there's absolutely no way they can accommodate all the numbers that are going to be coming in the existing prisons, even if they start going up and building higher. Certainly if they build out, they're going to run into limitations and already have in some of the prisons in terms of infrastructure, you know, adequate sewage, all of those sorts of things. But to my knowledge, even the current prison expansion plans don't include sufficient resources for things like recreation, programming, that sort of thing. It's really mostly focused around cell space. The situation will just become, unfortunately, will likely only become worse, and prison conditions will not become better. The access of people to educational resources will become more and more limited over time as the numbers go up.
What role does education play in the rehabilitation of prisoners?
Well, we know that it's countries with the highest literacy rates and the